We're going to go ahead and get started with this session. This is the session that's titled Getting to Yes, Progress Towards the Reportable Conditions Knowledge Management System. I know many of you have been in the discussions over the last couple of days where the RCKMS project has been referenced, and there's been a little discussion, but we're going to have the opportunity this morning to take a little bit of a deeper dive. And so I will move right along and introduce, show you how our agenda for the panel is laid out. Sue McGarvey, who is an informatics specialist with Northrop Grumman, contractor to the CDC, will provide an overview and background of the project. And then we'll have a presentation on our jurisdictional participation in our current feasibility pilot from Ryan Arnold. And Ryan is a biostatistician with the Office of Surveillance and Public Health Preparedness from the Houston Department of Health and Human Services. And then Lori Smithy will talk to us about the variation in reporting criteria and a specific use case of pertussis. And Lori is the Director of Acute Diseases at the Oklahoma State Department of Health. And then we'll have Jennifer Vahora, who's applied public health informatics fellow with the Illinois Department of Public Health in Northwestern University, and she'll talk about the state perspectives and how this project has impacted work that they're doing in Illinois. So with that, we will start our timing and ask you to come do the overview and background.
So, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here today. Rita Altamore, who has been invaluable to all of this, I don't know that it would be happening without her involvement, is unfortunately not able to be here, which is why I'm standing in this spot. I absolutely cannot fill her shoes. I will, however, try and give you an overview of RCKMS. Looking at the audience, it looks like most of you have been in conversations earlier today, yesterday, or Sunday. So I will be brief and allow the bulk of the presentation to be with my colleagues. I do want to start by saying this has been a hugely collaborative effort with CSTE jurisdictions who participated in this recent pilot, Houston, Illinois, Southern Nevada, and Virginia. Jurisdictions that have participated previously and are continuing to participate, including New York, Oklahoma, New York City, Delaware, Washington, Colorado, University of Utah, with our co-lead, Catherine Stace, who will hopefully be here today just for this session. She too has been invaluable in her breadth and depth of knowledge in this domain and topic area. HLN Consulting, our clinical decision support implementer and expert. Intermountain Healthcare, who has been our reporter. They are out of Utah and have been fabulous to work with. I think Shan is somewhere in here or will be soon. The Laboratory Interoperability Collaborative with Jeff Benning, the tall guy who you've seen in these meetings, is a spectacular facilitator. We're very fortunate to have him. CDC with Laura Kahn, our final co-lead, who, I don't know, none of this would happen without her. We're very fortunate. PHII and Jim Jellison in collaborations with other work being done at the CDC. It's been a fantastic group to work with, and we feel so fortunate. I'm going to go through this very briefly. RCKMS is intended to hold the who, what, when, where, and how of reporting, the reporting specifications. There's Shan. Right now, all that information is on websites, and it's different on different websites. This is Utah's, this is Massachusetts, and this is Washington State's. Different formats, different ways of expressing information, but very similar types of information. What conditions need to be reported, how quickly, to whom, by what method. But a lot of it's linked, all of it's text, none of it's standardized, computable, machine processable. So what is RCKMS? This leads perfectly into it. It's the repository of all of this information. But it takes the information and it translates it into logic that can sit within a public health decision support tool and be computable. It includes a shared service framework that allows you as a reporter to do things like access the public health decision support aspect of it to determine reportability, and also to do things like take trigger codes, manage them, and distribute them in conjunction with other shared services, like those to do routing on a public health community platform. What is it not? That's key. It is not a repository of completed case reports. That's not what RCKMS is intended to do. It's the repository of the metadata, of the specifications that you want reporters to follow in determining what to report. So here's the who, what, when, where, and how we just covered. And I won't go through that because I just said it. This has been going on for a long time, for over 10 years now, starting with the paper, A Knowledge Base to Support Notifiable Disease Surveillance, which was written by Richard Hopkins and Sam Grossclose and others back in 2005, followed by recommendations from the AHIC Population Health Work Group a couple years later to advance automated case reporting, followed by the recommendation to have a work group to standardize case reporting, which was completed, followed by a CSTE CDC state reportable conditions assessment, followed by recommendations from the ELR task force back in 2010-2011 that prioritized development of this tool, and finally with the impetus of stage 3 meaningful use in the NPRM. We've completed quite a bit of work already. Requirements have been defined. We've collected jurisdictional reporting specifications, defined default criteria for a number of conditions, participated in a healthy decisions pilot, developed recommendations on how to represent knowledge best through an ontology, through relational structures, through a combination and where, designed RCKMS screens and functions. Most of the work in this current pilot, Ryan will go through in detail, but here's the timeline. This current pilot ends in the next couple of months, and by then, we anticipate having 4 conditions and the default criteria and jurisdictional criteria for those, a tool to put all of that information in, translate it into computable rules logic in a decision support tool that can be hit to provide a determination of reportability back to a reporter, the reporter being Intermountain Healthcare, our partner. So progress is being made thanks to the collaborative efforts of all. Many people ask, what's the difference between RCKMS and SRCA? There is an overlap, but RCKMS includes a number of elements that SRCA does not have. It includes links and excerpts of legal documents and citations, contact information, information about where to report to and how to report, data elements about what to report, some of those other requirements that are supplementary and ancillary currently on websites and posters that need to be put into a tool where they're more accessible. And key, the information, rather than just being text-based, will also be machine processable. People also ask, well, what's the difference between RCKMS and RCMT, the reportable condition mapping table? Well, RCMT holds lab information, LOINC codes, SNOMED codes. RCKMS is intended to extend beyond that to hold clinical criteria, demographic criteria, epidemiologic criteria, in addition to the lab criteria, but honed down a bit from what RCMT has, because RCMT was intended to be this huge, broad net, in some cases not specific enough, in other cases too specific. We really need to refine it to be what public health needs, and that's part of this effort. These are the things that are not in RCMT that RCKMS is intending to hold. So I think everyone has seen these diagrams. This serves as a reminder. This was some of the information that needs to be set up as a part of electronic case reporting. And this is a reminder that the RCKMS pilot, our current pilot, is dealing with authoring and is dealing with providing the trigger codes that could be implemented at a reporter end to do the initial triggering, that initial call out to see if something is reportable. Those are our components of focus. Notice we're not dealing with the form repository and we're not dealing with routing. That's outside of our pilot scope, hopefully to be done by others. Where's Wes? Where's Paula?
Right here.
This being the overall flow of electronic case reporting, even in the last few days, I've seen this diagram evolve and be refined, which has been fabulous. The aspects on here that are RCKMS are here and here. These are our pilot components. The public health decision support, determination of reportability, and again, working with the reporter to implement trigger codes and generate a payload. Finally, the second part is sending that notice of reportability. So this is the RCKMS pilot, and this is what my colleagues will be speaking to you about in far more detail concerning our findings. So with that being said, I'll turn it back to Laura.
We bet you how long she would take. She did it, so we're excited. So now we'll have.
I've been told I'm long-winded. I can't believe it.
So now we'll have Ryan Arnold from Houston talk about the jurisdictional participation in the pilot.
All right. Thank you, Laura, and thank you, Shu, for giving us the introduction. Of course, we're missing Rita, so it was great that you two could fill in for her. As Shu mentioned, I'm from Houston Department of Health and Human Services, and we've been participating as one of the pilot jurisdictions for the current RCKMS feasibility pilot. So I'm going to try to give some of the jurisdictional participation on that pilot and then also give a perspective from the jurisdictions on moving forward with RCKMS in the future. Some of the goals and objectives are we're going to discuss reporting considerations at the local level. This really boils down to what are the problems and how can RCKMS be an answer to those problems. I want to explain the general public health healthcare work group process and outcomes. This has been a central work group to the pilot project. As Shu mentioned, it's a multidisciplinary collaboration. So I'm going to go into some of the outcomes that we've seen from that work group. We're going to evaluate the feasibility of creating base content for the RCKMS. I'm just going to briefly touch on this one as it's going to be central to Lori's presentation after me. We'll review the harmonization efforts and the ability to maintain jurisdiction-specific criteria and demonstrate moving from human-readable to machine-processable information. So some of the reporting considerations that we have. Each state and some local regional jurisdictions define their own reporting criteria. Of course, these are usually put forward in statutes and rules. For instance, in Texas, the health and safety code reads that a board will essentially develop what is going to be reportable, when it's going to be reportable, and how it's going to be reportable. The statute really only says who are the reporters. And this we've seen in the pilot process vary vastly between jurisdictions. We need RCKMS to be able to accommodate the very different reporting situations from state to state. So it's not just enough to prescribe, you know, this is what RCKMS is going to be able to do, but we need to move beyond that and say, well, if the jurisdiction needs it to do more, they're able to do that. So I'll be describing that in just a bit. Some of the deficiencies we've seen in reporting, obviously timeliness is a big issue. You know, we see cases coming in that should be being reported immediately, 4 or 5 days, and this is really a big impact on public health response. Completeness. Whenever we onboard ELR, I'm sure whoever has been familiar with that in the room, we see a large volume increase of reporting, and that to me indicates that we're not having complete reporting from a lot of these laboratories, and likely we're not having the same level of reporting from providers as well. We have a lack of understanding of the requirements. You know, in Texas we have 82 notifiable conditions. That's a lot for providers, and laboratories, and facilities to keep track of. And this all kind of boils down to resource requirements at the local and state levels. So we want to ask, what can RCKMS do to remedy some of these problems? The hope is that RCKMS can give a decision back to the laboratories, the providers, the facilities through their EHR in near real time that says, you know, this is reportable, this is how you need to report it, and these are the elements that we need included with that report. Along with that, we're hoping to get completeness. We'll be taking that decision out of the providers, out of the laboratories, and out of the facilities' hands and automating that for them, which again will obviously decrease the lack of understanding of the requirements. And this should all ultimately lead to less resource needs at the local and state level. The time that we spend liaising with providers, educating providers on reporting requirements, following up on cases if they're incomplete in order to determine if they're probable, suspect, confirmed, this sort of work takes a long time at the ground level. So I want to cover the RCKMS feasibility pilot. Shu had gone through the different stakeholders that we have engaged. I've listed them here again. I want to highlight what the public health jurisdictions have been doing on the work group, though. We've been working through 4 pilot conditions, pertussis, chlamydia, tuberculosis, and lead. We've been collecting all of the reporting requirements from the people involved in the work group, comparing those against CSCE position statements or those national standards, and figuring out how we can create base content for the RCKMS. We've also been contributing guidance and feedback to the RCKMS authoring interface. This is the portal that would allow jurisdictions to enter their reporting requirements, to manage those requirements moving forward if things were to change, to alter those in near real time, and therefore updating hospitals at the same time with what is reportable. And we've also began conducting testing of the system through submitting test cases to the RCKMS. We've started considering, you know, if we see a patient who has X, Y, and Z, is that going to meet our needs in RCKMS and tell the provider that that is yes, reportable, no, reportable, or maybe reportable if we can collect a little bit more information. As far as creating base content, this is sort of what you could get out of the box, if you will, from RCKMS. You know, you can open up RCKMS and see what we've developed for blood lead as far as consolidating these various jurisdictional reporting requirements against the national statements. I also want to cover the two major considerations that we have had in creating base content. One of them is the jurisdictional variation and comparing that against the national standards. And then the next one is moving from human-readable to machine-processable information. And of course, you know, we make these regulations for humans to consume. You know, we can say, well, we want blood lead to be reported to us within 2 days for every blood lead test reported in Texas, but we want to look at how do we get a machine to understand that as well. The approach has been to, again, collect the reporting requirements from the members of the public health healthcare work group and then consolidate these. In that process, we've been considering the sensitivity and specificity of reporting requirements. We've tended to err towards being more sensitive, which would kind of cast a larger net as far as what we'd be collecting as far as the automated case reportings in the future. We've also created logic for healthcare and laboratories separately. We started out not necessarily on this track, but we quickly realized that what's available to a laboratory is not necessarily what's available to a provider, and how we're determining what meets case definitions are going to be separate depending on what's available in those systems. In a couple instances, such as tuberculosis, we do see that those sometimes overlap, and we do need to create kind of an integrated provider logic set that includes laboratory requirements and clinical requirements, but usually they've been developed separately. And we've also evaluated the criteria for feasibility to implement an RCKMS. And essentially what this is if we put into RCKMS that we want an EPI-linked criteria, is that going to be able to be translated into machine-processable information? And for the most part, for the EPI information, we haven't been able to come up with a way that that'll happen. But as far as the clinical information, the laboratory information, obviously these are codified variables and standardized across EHRs. So there should be a pretty ubiquitous solution for most reports. So now that we have base content, at least for four conditions, we have some 70 more to go, I think. And we need your help to do it. So now the jurisdictions can either adopt the base content, again, what's out of the box, if you will, as their reporting logic in RCKMS. This can be a great tool for reducing variability between jurisdictions. But we also realize that we need the jurisdictions to be able to modify the base content or create new content depending on their reporting requirements. We've been calling this applying localizations to the requirements. An example is for, my examples for the rest of the slide deck will be blood lead. The base content that we've developed, it's very simple. Blood lead is the most simple of the four that we've dealt with. It includes laboratory reporting for all lead results and case reporting for all results above 5 micrograms per deciliter. So essentially we're asking all laboratories to send us every result that they produce, and then the providers and facilities to write up the case reports only for those that are above that 5 microgram per deciliter reference range. So this slide is showing us the authoring interface for RCKMS. Again, we have the blood lead reporting criteria. We see the laboratory reporting criteria on the left as a reporting time frame of 2 days and sufficient underneath the lead testing performed on blood. Again, asking the laboratory to send all blood test results to public health. The second column is the provider facility reporting. Again, it's 2 days, but instead of having every lab test, we have a lab test performed and the result is greater than or equal to 5 micrograms per deciliter. Again, that's the second column there. But what if your jurisdiction didn't want all lab results? We could say we just wanted lab results, like we want for providers, just above 5 micrograms per deciliter. So with the authoring interface here, that's very easily done. It's based off of sufficients, necessaries, and optionals, which I think Laurie will be going into a little bit more detail. But I just want to cover that jurisdictions will have the opportunity to modify this base content or even create new content in the case of diseases that aren't nationally notifiable but are notifiable in your state. And eventually, this can act as a master repository, as Shu had mentioned, for how we're collecting information nationwide. And that comes into play when we start thinking about making incidence and prevalence estimates. Next thing I want to cover is moving from human-readable to machine-processable. Again, reporting requirements were created by legislatures, health departments, and others for reporters. These are humans creating requirements for other humans, which is great. It's worked up until now, but now we need to move towards automated case reporting. And outside of ELR, moving these requirements to a language that can be automated for reporting has not really been done. I know there's been a couple small projects here and there, but as far as a nationwide project goes, we really need to start moving towards this direction. So the Public Health Healthcare Workgroup has worked on ensuring that the rules accurately represent requirements and that they produce the results that we expect. And the way that we do this is we submit test cases against RCKMS, again asking, you know, if a patient has X, Y, and Z, is that going to give us the result that we are expecting? And this will also be available to jurisdictions in the future, so when we're changing the or applying localizations, as we've been calling it, at the local level, are they getting what they need out of RCKMS? This here is really just a different representation of the grid that we looked at a couple slides ago. This is the laboratory reporting requirement for blood lead, again, all lead results. And I just want to show you this. This is more of the human-readable component that is available in RCKMS. And then in a minute, we'll be looking at the machine-readable. And then this is the same just for the clinical. Again, all lead blood results above 5 micrograms. And this is the Drools rules. I'm not sure. You don't really need to be able to read them. The computer needs to be able to read them. But on the top half, we have the lab facility. And the bottom half, we have the provider facility. Again, the jurisdictions aren't writing these. When we put the information into RCKMS in this format, in this human-readable format, RCKMS will give this out. And this is essentially what is being tested against in the RCKMS for the public health decision support. And moving towards the conclusion, we're moving forward with case reporting as we've been talking about for the last few days here at CSTE. We need a common platform for defining what is reportable, how it's reportable, when it's reportable, and by whom it's reportable. We also need to define the base content for the nationally notifiable conditions. Not only do we need to define the base content, we need to be able to author unique requirements for each jurisdiction. What we need in Texas or in Houston could obviously be vastly different from what we need here in Massachusetts. Having said that, though, it would be great to start having serious conversations about reducing variation between states, especially for common diseases. You know, things like chikungunya obviously are going to affect the South a lot more than the North in the future, but for conditions that are common across all the states, all the jurisdictions, we've learned in the public health healthcare work group that the level of variation is it's extraordinary, and it's somewhat unacceptable. So I think we need to really start having those serious conversations, and I'm hoping y'all will join us, and Lori will plug this as well for the roundtable at 1 o'clock in the Berkeley room upstairs. And I want to close with the idea that RCKMS can do this for you. It can make case reporting a lot easier. It can make case reporting more timely, more complete, and it will decrease resources at the jurisdiction level, but we have a long ways to get there. Thank you.
So, Lori Smithy from Oklahoma will now talk to us about variation. It was a great lead-in, Ryan, related to pertussis.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm happy to be able to speak to you about this variation that we're finding here and how we can still accommodate that, as well as possibly resolve some of that as we move forward with RCKMF. So we have some objectives just for the talk that I'm giving, which is to briefly describe a little bit more about our process that we used with the pilot sites and the RCKMS work group, to describe the variation or some of the variation that we found specifically for pertussis, because I can't go through all four of our pilot conditions, and then to suggest some items to ponder as we move forward, problems to solve or things that we need to chew on a little bit. And that we need the involvement not just of the RCKMS work group, but the CDC and the CSTE, all of our participant jurisdictions, really, to accomplish this project. So in our process was that we started with the logic sets for, in this example, pertussis as are defined in the CSTE case definition, and we added the reporting criteria in the following categories, which are clinical, death record, demographic, epidemiologic, and laboratory, and jurisdiction. So you can see here, this is a picture from our Excel file. This is showing that we started with the national CSTE logic sets for reporting in the four areas that I just described. That's in the red circle at the top. And in, down the rows on the left are the clinical criterion that are established in the CSTE case definition. In this particular example, you're also seeing some that were added by the jurisdictions. And those that are added by the jurisdictions, you see are, surrounded with a little red circle, there's a letter J. That indicates that this was a criteria that was added by one of the jurisdictions in the pilot sites. And then we use the traditional necessary, sufficient, and optional criteria that are described in the CSTE case definitions in our logic sets. So this is a little bit, of a busy slide, but I want to point a couple of things out. In the logic sets, you'll note here with the two blue arrows at the top, that some of our jurisdictions added logic sets for if they wanted to receive negative laboratory reports or preliminary laboratory reports for certain conditions. And so we chose to include those as columns so that we could look at those across the laboratory criteria in the rows that were going down the spreadsheet. You'll notice in these boxes, in our four pilot sites again, are Houston, Illinois, Southern Nevada, and Virginia, and I'll go through them always in that same order. The provider, reporting of a diagnosis here in red, or the provider reporting of symptoms here in green, those logic sets were shared by Houston, Southern Nevada, and Virginia. And those are the same two criteria or logic sets that are established in the CSTE case definitions. Here, Illinois is going a little bit maybe more broad, but it's also simply just a change in terminology that I want to point out, and we'll see this as we go forward, that Illinois is asking for clinician reporting with laboratory data or clinician reporting without laboratory data. So sometimes when we go forward and we talk about the harmonization, we're really talking about some minor differences in terminology that we're able to come together on. So with regard to our logic sets, this is how our pilot sets or pilot sites would appear on a Venn diagram. So items two and three, you can see here, those are the provider reporting of diagnosis and the provider reporting of symptoms of pertussis. And those are shared by three jurisdictions, which are Houston, Southern Nevada, and Illinois. And over here, we have laboratory reporting of pertussis, which is shared by Houston, Southern Nevada, and Illinois as well. Virginia. Houston, Illinois, and Virginia. So keep in mind as we go forward that some of these are minor differences in terminology, and we'll see that as we move on towards harmonization or kind of joining of some of these differences. So with regard to clinical criteria, I blew this up a little bit so that you in the back could see it a little bit better. But these are some of the criteria that are clinical that were added by the jurisdictions. You see the J's here. So an infant with apnea is specifically a criteria that was added. Diagnosis as, or suspected or confirmed diagnosis of pertussis. diagnosis of pertussis confirmed. Again, these are wording differences, but these were added by jurisdictions to the criteria list. Six. Here we're looking at the clinical criteria for Houston and Illinois. And so as we can see here, Houston has a little bit more extensive reporting of a provider diagnosis of pertussis, a provider reporting of symptoms, or even a provider reporting of infant with symptoms. And this really represents, I think, just an effort to capture more of the clinical cases. And so compared to Illinois, which is capturing more of the diagnoses rather than simply a clinical case, that's particularly also with regard to the specific CSTE established criteria such as post-tussive vomiting. So this is a difference maybe in sensitivity between what Houston would like to receive and then what Illinois would like to receive. And this is similar. This is showing you with regard to the clinical criteria, Southern Nevada and Virginia. And again, Southern Nevada is actually requesting more clinical criteria for reporting. You can see that they have a more extensive list. And again, it would be more sensitive in capturing more of the suspected cases to be reported into their system, whereas Virginia is opting to go strictly more with a diagnosis of pertussis or the healthcare record contains a diagnosis of pertussis. And so this would be how it would appear on a Venn diagram displaying these clinical criteria, where number 7, 8, and 9, which are shared by Houston, Illinois, and Southern Nevada, are the pertussis as a significant contributor to death, or pertussis as a cause of death, or pertussis documented as in the death record. And then item number 3, which is shared also by 3 of the pilot sites, is the healthcare record contains a diagnosis of pertussis. And this is a more long list of what the jurisdictions input into the laboratory criteria. So here, I just want to point out that many of these things are slight differences in terminology. So in this section, we have several different ways of saying pertussis by rapid test or nucleic acid test or PCR. And this is displaying where Houston, with much more sensitivity, is requesting a longer list of tests. And again, I think I forgot to mention earlier that we asked the jurisdictions to input the criteria exactly as they would have them in rule or law or policy at their health department. So these are actually reflecting written policies of those jurisdictions. So Houston captures a very, very specific list of laboratory tests, whereas Illinois is capturing just broadly detection of pertussis by PCR or positive serology by PCR. And I think you're seeing a similar thing here. In Southern Nevada, they also have a much more extensive list of exactly what they want to have reported. And again, Virginia is capturing some more broad categories of laboratory tests that they want to see reported. And this is how it would show up on a Venn diagram, where number 6 is the isolation of pertussis from a clinical specimen by culture. And that's actually captured by Illinois. It's just stated a little bit differently. So there's a few other criteria. Pertussis contributing as a documented on a death record. Demographic criteria concerning age less than 1 year or less than 2 years. And then the epi criteria. So cases that are related to a lab-confirmed case or cases that are found during an outbreak with 3 or more suspected cases. And this is how those other criteria would appear. Houston is collecting, again, much with greater sensitivity and greater reporting of clinical cases. They're collecting more information on persons with symptoms that may be related to other cases. And also they're collecting information on infants or children under 2 years of age and not just the infants under 1 year of age. And in Southern Nevada and Virginia, here in Southern Nevada, we're seeing the criteria for infants under 2 years of age. That's their definition rather than just 1 year of age, wanting to really expand that infant age group a little bit. And we're not seeing as much required reporting of the epi-linked cases. So here's just the Venn diagram of our demographic criteria, where we have one jurisdiction that's looking strictly at 1 year of age and 2 year of age, and then another jurisdiction that is looking at infants or children under 2 years of age. And our EPI criteria, where Houston has expanded and really asked providers to begin to try to identify and report some of those EPI-linked cases. And then our jurisdiction criteria, where it's defined as care provided in the jurisdiction, lab located in the jurisdiction, or a resident of the jurisdiction. And so you can see here that Houston is requiring reporting only if the person seen by the provider is a resident of the jurisdiction, whereas Illinois is requiring care provided in the jurisdiction or residents of the jurisdiction to be reported. Southern Nevada is doing the same here. And then Virginia is also requiring reporting only if the case is a resident of their jurisdiction. And this is how it's displayed. So I kind of just want to give a super brief overview of the process and then move on into just description of the harmonization a little bit. So the jurisdiction criteria, as you saw, was much more extensive. We had the large box is designed just to tell you that we had a large list of criteria across clinical, across laboratory, et cetera. And then as we identified joint or shared criteria that were due to differences in terminology, we developed what we called roll-up criteria, where we combined those together. And ultimately, as we went through our process, we took our roll-up criteria and condensed them even further into the proposed criteria for the default sets that you will see in RCKMS. I think the important thing to know here is that as we move to smaller boxes, it's kind of counterintuitive, but in many cases, our sensitivity is actually increasing. So I think that's an important point for you to ponder. So we're shortening our laboratory list, for example, but in requesting that all positive laboratory tests be reported, we may actually, in our default criteria, be requesting more laboratory reports than you're typically used to receiving in your jurisdiction. So that's an important consideration. So here's our proposed logic sets. We have, of course, laboratory reporting, and then provider reporting by symptom only, by EPI criteria, by diagnosis, or in an infant. And so, isn't this wonderful? You see that through harmonization, I just love this, through harmonization, everybody's harmonious. No, they all came together. And so what you're seeing here is a Venn diagram that's showing you the provider reporting based on symptoms. And everyone has agreed that they would want cough of any duration to be reported as a necessary item, along with either an inspiratory whoop or paroxysmal coughing or post-testive vomiting. And again, we see a harmonious diagram for provider reporting based on diagnosis. And this is showing us that we would ask for a healthcare record containing a diagnosis of pertussis, pertussis documented in a death record, or a healthcare record indicating pertussis as a cause of death to be reported through RCKMS. And again, what I'm describing is the default criteria that would be in RCKMS. This would be provider reporting of an infant with pertussis, and this is agreement on apnea along with a cough or a cough of any duration. And then this is provider reporting based on EPI criteria, in which item number 3 is a cough of any duration if there's an indication that it might be related to other cases. And what I guess I want to point out is that RCKMS is going to be functionally malleable, so that if you're in an outbreak scenario or situation and you would like to change your EPI criteria, for example, to capture more cases, you would be able to do that, I would say, on the fly or very readily in RCKMS. So this just shows our roll-up of laboratory criteria. The green is how we condensed lab test positive or detection of pertussis by IgM, detection by antigen test or PCR. All of those differences in jurisdiction terminology that you see right here were essentially collapsed into the green category. And so with regard to laboratory, that's displayed kind of rolled up for the laboratory criteria of reporting in this diagram, where we see that number two and number four are agreed upon by all the jurisdictions, and this is detection of pertussis by a nucleic acid test or the detection of pertussis by PCR. And then we have some ancillary or additional tests that other jurisdictions might add in to that default reporting. And so, let's see. Sorry. And that's caused us to result in just a broad category of any test positive for laboratory. Any laboratory test positive for pertussis would be kind of the proposed, harmonized, you know, final criteria for reporting in RCKMS. So I think it's an interesting point that if we're saying in RCKMS we want any positive laboratory test to be reported, again, that increases the sensitivity. So when you as a jurisdiction would be looking at that in RCKMS, that might be your opportunity to say, no, we don't want every single test to be reported. We would only like a PCR positive or a culture positive, and you would be able to input that. And I think what we haven't maybe described sufficiently is that RCKMS will contain all of the value sets for these laboratory tests and for the clinical criteria, such that when the machine is reading the medical record and RCKMS is sharing information, then it will be using those defined and standardized value sets to gather information. So, and this is our harmonization of other criteria, the death record, demographic criteria, and epi criteria. And I just wanted to kind of put a little question mark out there for jurisdiction reporting, because I have kind of a little scenario that I want to talk my way through with you, but because I think it's going to be important as we move to a more machine-readable scenario that we still keep in context some traditional methods of sharing information. Oh, I'm supposed to stop. The only scenario is that shouldn't a person, say, from Oklahoma decide to visit the great state of Virginia and become ill and seek care and get a positive test for pertussis and a diagnosis of pertussis, if the Virginia provider here hits the RCKMS and is going to ask, is this case reportable, and RCKMS is going to come back and say, yes, not in Virginia because it's an Oklahoma resident, but it's reportable to Oklahoma. So the clinical system doesn't report to Oklahoma. It'll go ahead and follow its traditional scenario and report to the state of Virginia. And then hopefully Virginia will take that and turn around in the traditional manner. We don't yet have an electronic manner, but a traditional manner, and share that interstate jurisdiction. I think I have to stop. Okay, I do have some next steps. Let me share those with you. Okay, so we have some important work as we go forward. I think Ryan said something about 70 conditions. I think what's really important to know is that to completely go through and work through the RCKMS model and move to electronic case reporting, we need coordination amongst all public health personnel. We're going to need good communication and working groups to create the criteria for all of these other diseases, and the commitment of the buy-in and buy-in of public health personnel to spend some time to work through those. We're going to need to get input from terminology experts and some of those persons who are used to putting in the value sets, which are important. And then we'll also need your input and discussion, maybe identifying people in your program areas that can help with this as we go forward. So just a plug to be thinking about this and maybe join us for the roundtable this afternoon. Other things are, as you can see, that some of this may require you to go back and look at your rules, your administrative rules or guidelines for reporting, to see how those might need to be modified, if at all, to come to consensus with more an RCKMS model of sharing of information. Thank you.
I'll be talking today about how participating in the pilot is part of the larger, broader surveillance landscape, using Illinois' experience as a participant in this pilot. So I'll preface this by saying that we in Illinois have found our participation in this pilot to be extremely valuable. And I'll say why and how later in my presentation. but partly because the pilot itself is a forum for shared ideas. There's no other place that we know of that exists where we can all come together and just openly discuss unique and shared reporting rules. So for example, I just put a couple examples on the slide, how Utah actually, you know, we discussed how they accept negative STD test results to generate denominators and to determine incidence rates and prevalence. And we also discussed how in New Jersey, they not only collect blood lead, but they also collect hair samples to test for blood lead. So it's just very for lead concentration. It's very interesting the differences that exist and the fact that this pilot has created or presented itself as a forum for sharing those ideas and those shared but also very different concepts and approaches. So today I wanted to specifically talk about state initiatives that have impacted that have been impacted by RCKMS in Illinois. I'm going to talk about the Meaningful Use Stage 3 public health option, how our approach to that has been impacted by participating in this pilot, ambulatory syndromic surveillance use cases, and specifically for Illinois, the Hepatitis C Community Alliance to Test and Treat, which I'll refer to as HEPCAT going forward. So Meaningful Use Stage 2, Stage 1 before that, and then soon to be Stage 3, which is in draft form. Having expanded from just the capability to submit to submitting for the entire reporting period, we in the pilot had Intermountain, which was our healthcare provider, and they had a homegrown EHR system. And they're transitioning or have transitioned to a more commercial system, I believe it's Cerner. And so it's interesting when you're onboarding providers with just a sheer number, how many different systems out there exist, there's so much room for differential interpretation in interpreting just reporting rules. So I wanted to talk about how we often discuss the concept of reporting every 24 hours. So when you ask yourself that, you know, how do the vendors actually define reporting every 24 hours? Does it mean that you're going and reporting the visit within 24 hours, within, or are you reporting a visit or data from a visit that occurred 2 to 3 days ago every 24 hours? So that's something that we thought about when we were participating in this pilot, that yes, we had one healthcare system, which had a homegrown EHR system, but if we were to do that with multiple healthcare systems, with multiple different commercial-based systems or their own homegrown systems, what kinds of issues would we face? And then I also wanted to talk about our efforts in Illinois to do ambulatory syndromic surveillance and developing use cases for that. So as we get more and more providers, specialty, primary care, there's an opportunity for Illinois to routinely receive health data from settings other than emergency departments and urgent care centers. And so in Illinois, we implemented a medical study directive with providers in the greater Chicago area, including a multi-state safety net provider and the largest health system in the state of Illinois. So this study allows us to work with these healthcare partners and the Medical Research Analytics and Informatics Alliance that we have in Chicago to expand syndromic surveillance to ambulatory care providers. And we applied principles learned from the RCKMS pilot to approach syndromic surveillance with ambulatory care providers. So just as we had discussions about triggers for TB reporting within the pilot and all those pilot calls that were led by Jeff over here, so, you know, specifically for TB, it's a discussion to be worth to think about just because of how long and drawn out that was and how we debated so much over just which drugs, which TB drugs would trigger a report to public health. And so right now, you know, when you have syndromic surveillance, each time the EHR is updated, does that trigger a report to public health? Is that necessary, though? That's the question that we asked ourselves. And so myself and my mentor, Stacy, who's in the audience right now, when we work with these healthcare partners that we have for this medical study directive, we're trying to look for ways to reduce the number of triggers. Just reduce it from, you know, every time it's updated to for each test that's ordered, for every lab test result that's obtained, to something that's a little bit more manageable. What actually is necessary to be reported is the broader question that we're asking here. Also, also in Illinois, we have something that I mentioned earlier, is the Hepatitis C Community Alliance to Test and Treat, which for shorthand is called HEPCAT. HEPCAT is actually a $6.2 million grant from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And the goal of that is to lead a public health collaboration between academic medical centers, community health centers, pharmacies, and state and local health departments like the Chicago Department of Public Health and the Illinois Department of Public Health to reduce hepatitis C infections in Chicago. The goal is just basically to test and link hepatitis C positive individuals to care. And there are four key areas in it. And I'm just going to highlight the third bullet point here, which is robust surveillance to monitor population level changes in hepatitis C testing, treatment, and cure. So surveillance itself is a key component of the HEPCAT, and it'll help ensure if there's follow-up and continuity of care. But we at IDPH, at the Illinois Department of Public Health, are working with Northwestern University to design, create, and implement HEPCAT's technology infrastructure, which includes linking de-identified clinical data from multiple sources, including Chicago's major hospitals, community health center partners, and participating pharmacies. So the system itself, the goal is to enable real-time reporting to the health department on the number of people tested for hepatitis C, the number who test positive, the number receiving treatment, and the number of people cured. So how do we take a grant like HEPCAT, which you know is Illinois-specific, and there's another grantee in another state, but no other jurisdiction or pilot is participating in HEPCAT. But so if you look at just how I mentioned earlier, how Utah collects these negative test results for STDs, if you look at expanding the collection of negative test results to specific conditions of interest, so in this case, conditions that present a high and especially yet to be quantified public health burden like STDs and hepatitis C, HEPCAT itself would collect negative test results to determine those denominators to better quantify the public health burden, that the disease burden that hepatitis C has in Chicago. So I also wanted to talk about and reference specifically two conditions, so two discussions that we had. So we had TB and just what triggers, what TB medications would trigger a report to public health. And then just differences in case definitions. So for example, in Illinois, we collect suspect case definitions. So we have that in Illinois, but it's not true for all jurisdictions that participate in the pilot and not all jurisdictions in general. And all of this just leads to asking what constitutes a good public health use case. So a discussion that I had with Judy, who also participates with me in this pilot, is that EHRs present access to new technology. But with the availability of new technology, we often lose sight of many things. We lose sight of what we really need. What should we prioritize? What payoff there'll be, i.e. access to data. And it also just highlights the fact that we need to focus on public health use cases, not just the fact that we'll have just availability to extreme amounts of data that we may or may not know what to do with. But there's great potential in EHRs. There's just a very long way to go. And at the end of this, you know, we just have to ask ourselves, you know, we have all this data. What are the plans to use it? What are the plans put these things into action? So the last thing that I wanted to talk about is the overall goal of this pilot is to reduce variability. But this pilot may actually lead to increased variation simply because each jurisdiction has different priorities. So, and Rita Altamore and I had this discussion as to, you know, what actually leads to those differences in priorities? You know, Is it because there are differences in disease burden? So in this pilot, we looked at TB, we looked at pertussis, we looked at chlamydia, we looked at blood lead. But I mentioned earlier how in Illinois, you know, we also have hepatitis C, and that's a priority for us here in Illinois, or in Illinois. And so we have a grant, and so that's something, you know, that's a resource. You know, there's time, there's money, there's staff time allocated to that. But specifically, you have to also look at something that's common across all jurisdictions is STDs. And we in Illinois have focused a lot on something on STD registry. And the reason why we're focusing so much time and effort on an STD registry is just because of the sheer volume of cases we receive. I was talking with Judy earlier, and you know, in Illinois we get over 6,000 cases of STDs reported each month. And so there's this desire to reduce that disease burden that's there. And so we then create these informatics projects, STD registries and HepCat, that then make us a little different from other jurisdictions. So given the fact that we have differential disease burdens, we then allocate different resources to them, and that leads to variation across jurisdictions with what they do, with the data that they collect, and ultimately what programs and what actions they implement. And so I'm going to turn this over to Next Step Consideration.
So thank you to our panelists. I'll just spend a minute or two talking about, I think each of the panelists talked about some next steps in each of these things, but as a broad activity in RCKMS, having a set of guiding principles for how we move this forward to a production level system that can support case reporting, and having that laid out, and so that we're all, as a public health community, working towards that goal, and that we have a broad representation of the interests in this from the clinical care sector, who will provide or receive information from this, but from the public health perspective, that will be inputting this information in order to help better achieve the case reports and the information that you want to receive in your jurisdictions, making sure that we're doing this, we're keeping our eye on where things are going, so that we're while we're moving forward incrementally, that we have a strategy of how to take advantage of what's going on in clinical care and new technologies and other things that make us execute in a way that will have a product that can be sustainable and serve its purpose in the long term. As she mentioned at the very beginning, and you saw the list of collaborators, it's been the key to success of getting where we are now, and we have to build that that group from more jurisdictions and more include more representatives, but we are here to ask you to come along with us and join in these discussions. As they've said, we'll be continuing this at 1 o'clock in the Berkeley room with discussions about variation. And I think Jennifer left us with, how do we balance that? There's definitely times when we need variation and it makes sense. But there's also times where it looks like it's variation because it's a terminology thing, that if we tweak, we could be more consistent in our interactions with clinical care and just make it much easier for them without a lot of change on our side. So we want to think through that. As I said, we're coming to the end of this pilot. The intention is over the next period of time to move this into a production level system. And we have to continue to, as was mentioned, build the criteria for all conditions and determine how to prioritize those to get those in, so that we can have default criteria defined and then move towards the specific jurisdictional criteria. And there are a lot of efforts that are going on that will be going on in parallel that we need to make sure that we're coordinating well. Many of you have been in the discussions of the just broader case reporting discussions of the community platform and other activities related that need to move together down a path and converge to come together to support the full system. So we're looking forward to that. We have plenty of time, I think, for questions, so I'd invite you to come up and introduce yourself and ask the panelists questions.
I'll go first.
Sure, thanks.
Jim Ellison, Public Health Informatics Institute. Thanks for the presentations. Looking forward to the roundtable at 1 o'clock. You've all talked about the issue of reporting criteria variability, and I'm wondering if there's been talk about how RCKMS could be a tool that could do analyses or visualizations of that variability that might inform this communications effort to reduce that variability.
Pass that to whoever wants to put that.
as a repository for all the variability nationwide. So from that repository, which would include both the human readable and the machine processable variability, that could be definitely a future goal of or future use of RCP in that second. But as far as visualization goes, not necessarily.
I think we need to add that to the backlog, Jim. That's definitely a use of the data that we're collecting. One thing that I will mention is we're making efforts to tie the reportable conditions to their notifiable counterparts and have an ontology that shows and tracks the changes so that as notifiable conditions are divided into subtypes or grouped into a supertype or change in other ways over time, the related jurisdiction specifications will also be tracked, which should help CDC when CDC receives reports in knowing what criteria jurisdictions receive their reports on and subsequently reported to CDC based on.
Campaign on pilot. And question for you guys. And first of all, I was wondering about the on-the-fly ability as outbreaks occur. I had questions of why I hear that RCPMS will have that ability. But then I also wondered, and I think we're getting close to this, but is there going to be a repository of questions that have been added by other jurisdictions? So perhaps that might reduce the variability a little bit so that if in Ohio I'm looking for something to ask about immigration cost, I can see, oh, Illinois asked it, this is how they asked it.
Yes. So the ability for jurisdictions to specify criteria that they're adding and for other jurisdictions to use that criteria rather than creating another version. Good question.
And I think it's also important to mention that the criteria are associated with value sets that will be common across jurisdictions that can be used by multiple jurisdictions and can also be altered.
Dan.
Hi, Dan Jabut, ONC. I heard the dreaded on the fly, change the system on the fly. Any CDC program will probably tell you about the little change they released on the fly that was really simple and, you know, the end result of that. So what are the plans for actually releasing your on the fly changes, regression testing? I mean, I'm hoping folks can't, like, real-time go in and just tweak a number here, a number there, and I will follow up to that.
Mm-hmm. So that, it sounds like on the fly is scary for you. But I think what I was trying to say is there are existing, similar to the question before, there will be existing questions and existing criteria within the system that could be used to increase the sensitivity for an outbreak, for example, or shut down that sensitivity and go back to maybe general reporting based on standard laboratory testing if the jurisdiction is really, really being specific about, you know, their program, increasing their specificity rather than their sensitivity. So I didn't really mean it to say that someone could type in necessarily a brand new question that that would just be posted immediately. Based on what I know of IT systems, that really doesn't really work, but shoot, and I need to talk more to the background or the back end of that.
Thanks, Laurie.
Put it closer to you, I think that doesn't work unless it's very close.
Thanks, Laurie. Is that in the...
That's
okay. So, yes, Dan. There's actually a quite a robust testing system within RCKMS where you can set up test scenarios and where you can do regression testing when things are changed. The on-the-fly changes, though, that Lori was referring to were more on the criteria being defined during an outbreak. Yes, you still need regression testing to ensure that what you're getting is what you anticipate and it's being processed properly. However, we're not talking about changes to code. We're not changing the software.
Mm-hmm.
We're changing the criterion. We're changing data.
So the follow-up question is, as you build, as you execute these rules and have your results and then you think about changing them, are you thinking about building any what-if modeling into the system for two reasons? One, to say, would this do to increase or decrease cases reported and how they're reported? And the fact that what-if modeling could also be used when you were trying to build consensus on the criteria in order to say to one jurisdiction or another, well, someone said, well, what will happen to my reporting if I change this? And you say, well, here's your existing reporting. If you change this and do this like the rest of the other states, it will have this impact. And then they can actually use that what-if modeling to come to consensus on a smaller step. So have you thought about what-if modeling and how you might accomplish?
It has actually come up, but I think it's come up because you've brought it up before. And we thought it was a fabulous idea.
This is a hint? Okay, this is the phase two that people will ask about.
Exactly.
I think it's the other thing that came up on Sunday was the idea of capturing the answers that come out that's no, so that if something else starts to think something's going on in your jurisdictions, you may be able to go back and look at things that might have been captured had we had different criteria, and then you can use that to adjust. So it's not exactly what you're talking about, but it's an analysis of here's different scenarios, what would be if.
And so just real quick, one of the things that Shu said right up front was this is not a repository of case reports. So
right.
One is similar to the one that I made yesterday, and I can't remember which session, but I think that in this whole move towards harmonization, which I definitely think we should be focusing on, I also think that we should be thinking about the minimum data set for that, because I know that this could get extraordinarily complex if you take it together. If you look at our report forms in New York City, the study of different diseases, you'd find so much detail there. I'm sure it would get inordinately complex. And I think for this purpose now, we should focus on what is the minimum required content for a case report, because a lot of what we ask for are elements that we get through case investigation, and it would be nice if we got them. But I don't think we should spend time trying to harmonize data that, unfortunately, I don't think actually often very structured in an EHR anyway. You can present your form, you can try and get those additional data. But I don't think we should, I think we should focus now on what are the minimum required elements for an initial case report. And I think that's a question that should be posed to the systems you're working with, because I think it's a very different question than what's all the information you want and what's on your reporting form now. Those are different questions.
Right.
So that's just one comment. The second is, I do think we should try to leverage what the laboratories have already done in terms of determining reportability, and I don't know where that fits in or how to bring it in, but I think it would be a shame to miss that opportunity.
Andy, those are great comments, and we're hoping you'll help us to do that.
But we did. We looked at it.
Yeah.
Our requirements, we would say, we're never going to get that, so why even put that in the trigger? Mm-hmm.
And we have had discussions with the national labs who try and keep track of this stuff and do a pretty good job, but it's very labor intensive for them as well. So we're considering, this is for sort of decision, public health decisions report about what's reportable and thinking broader in case reporting, we're thinking about how we can get the information that would be in RCKMS out so that national labs could benefit from it as well. So we've been having some of those discussions. It's just priority. Kaysen?
Yeah, Kaysen Schmidt, Public Health Law Program at the CDC. I'd appreciate if you could talk a little bit to the extent that for jurisdictions that have codified requirements and statutes and regulations, to the extent that legal counsel within those jurisdictions have been participating in the translation from the codification
work with policy committee at CSTE as well regarding how cases are defined and how the logic sets are defined and what criteria are requested.
And to give you the kind of Texas perspective, it's really left up to a board to determine what's reportable, and it just says in the code that this board will determine. So that leaves us a lot of flexibility in using a tool like RCKMS, but if you had a state where the codes were very specific about which tests are reportable, when they're reportable, so on and so forth, that jurisdiction would obviously need to opt out of using the base content and develop their own content for meeting those needs. That doesn't mean, you know, down the road we can't look at how to change those codes, you know, state by state, or, you know, what that process looks like to ultimately reduce variation, but I think that the option's there.
Question. My understanding is that RCKMS is not so much a tool for an application as it is guidelines for the development of tools and applications. And if that's the case, then I think we want guidelines that are broad and are also forward-looking. I mean, just because today's EMRs don't contain certain type of information doesn't mean that they won't be contained in the future. So if there are elements of information that we think are important, we should design guidelines to be able to capture them at some point, and then software can follow as those capabilities evolve. So with that in mind, a couple of thoughts for consideration. One is that we should embrace variability. It's not going to go away. And I think harmonization is important with respect to how we define elements that are common across jurisdictions. But harmonization shouldn't be constraining the elements across the jurisdictions, because we've already heard multiple reasons for why that variability is valid, and it's not going to change. Political considerations for what's reportable and when are extremely important. You're in Massachusetts, the Lyme disease crazy forced Lyme disease to be reported in a way that California never has to worry about. And it's ridiculous to force them both to do it the same way. And you don't have to do that. The guidelines can be broad enough to capture variability. And one way I think that you can achieve that, and also achieve the point that Dan made earlier about what-if analysis, is to actually have the capacity of the tools that are developed to broadly capture all of the information across all jurisdictions and then filter it by jurisdiction. Because if you filter, then you filter for real time, you can modify the filter for outbreaks, and you can modify the filter for what-if analysis. And that way, it seems like the job's made easier, because you don't have to decide between various types of elements, you just include all of them. And then the caveat for that, because there should always be caveats to everything, is that there are probably some crazy outliers that don't really need to be included in a national system that, you know, a local health department can gather on its own as needed, or a state can gather on its own as needed.
Great. So I saw Judy and Annie's hand
I
there.
I want to comment on that and make sure that everyone is aware we're looking at harmonizing where harmonization makes sense, but still allow for localization where it's necessary. So the idea is, let's harmonize what we can. Let's have consistency wherever we can. And then where you need to localize beyond that, localize. But don't just have everybody put in criteria the way that they want to put in criteria without taking into consideration where they can be consistent.
Judy?
Oh, yeah. I can
wait. Annie?
I just wanted to add something to what she said. Harmonization often makes sense in terms of manpower, because if each jurisdiction would need to input every single other one of their own criteria into the system, it would be a lot of manpower to do and maintain. So part of the harmonization effort is to establish default criteria that might be broadly acceptable, and then beyond that, the jurisdictions would be allowed to make those very specific changes, and it would take less manpower.
Which
you know, I think I brought that up earlier. We've got to work out the data flow because these are deal breaker questions.
Yep. So this is closely related to the triggering discussion of the broader case report. So you would theoretically have a new, updated reporting criteria in RCKMS that will live centrally in this public health decision support tool, but a corollary trigger that we've had those discussions, is this published subscribe or does it get pushed? And I think those conversations have to come together to make sense. That matched a trigger. So there's a set of filters, a very broad set of filters on the EHR side that comes over that then can hit that this more specific.
And those trigger codes would be provided. So if the codes change, they'd be provided. They'd be pushed out. It's a subscription notification model is the way we've been discussing it. Now other models are possible. And it is part of the discussion with APHL and with the community platform that needs to occur as to the actual mechanism that gets implemented.
So, the subscription notification model for the trigger.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then that filters down what gets sent to RCKMS, which further filters to the jurisdiction.
Right.
The jurisdiction gets an actual filter.
Yes.
Exactly.
Perfect. Thanks. Laurel?
Hi, Laurel Wood from Oregon. And I guess I am sort of thinking about RCKMS is sort of looking forward and creating guidelines for what data we should be expecting to receive back from EHRs. I guess I'd like to share my experience working with Grover Surveillance, seeing 300-year-old patients. Or like Marcus was talking about yesterday, seeing patients that were all born, you know, January 1st, 1900, because their date of birth was unknown. So I guess I'm wondering if there's any sort of
we're going to have to work through, and we believe that we'll not only need technical support in working with vendors during implementation, but also a very clear specification of that initial case message and what's required versus what's required but could be empty versus what's optional, and vary along with the associated business rules. Right now we're using the HL7 validated standard for clinical or communicating with clinical decision support, which is BMR. Mm-hmm. But as we all know, those standards are changing over time. CCDA has been brought up as an option. FHIR is on the horizon, and we're looking to be able to move toward those based on what the community decides.
Great. Well, we're up here between you and lunch, but I do want to take a minute to thank our CSTE staff lead, Janet Hoy, from the national office. She is an awesome coordinator of all of this. And also Denisha Abrams, who has been managing all these complex spreadsheets behind what you saw in the variation from our jurisdictions. So thank you, and thank you to our panelists.